Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Can I have your attention, please? I'm not quite sure why I'm standing here. I haven't been on the board 16 years, but apparently they're attempting to democratize the introducers of speakers, or alternatively the board is too lazy to show up themselves. Draw your own conclusions. But anyway, it's my privilege to be here to introduce Dr. Pavin Chachavalpongpon. But before I do that, I need to announce two forthcoming events. First one on June the 29th, Lee Chuk Yan, well-known local political figure, talking about Mission Impossible. And then on 13th of July, Christopher Dillon on Japanese real estate, bargain or black hole. So anyway, that's for the future. For today, Dr. Pavin has just published a book, Reinventing Thailand, Thaksin and His Foreign Policy. But as we know, Thaksin has been out of power now for nearly 4 years. So Dr. Pavin will talk certainly about his book, but also about the developments in Thailand since the overthrow of Thaksin and as they relate to foreign policy as well as to events today. So over to Dr. Pavin, who will be very willing to answer all your questions after his talk. Thank you.
Thank you, Philip, and good afternoon. I'm surprised that there's up to 60 people paid to come to hear me talk. Usually I give talk for free, so this is the first time, so I'm so privileged. So it means I worth something. Why am I interested in foreign policy issue? And not because I am a former diplomat. I just resigned from the foreign ministry in February this year. Or maybe they kicked me out because I talk too much. But I realized that Thailand foreign policy has been little studied, and I think it's very important to look back at the Thaksin period from 2001 to 2006. To me, this is the most interesting period, not only in domestic politics, but also in the area of foreign policy. I will stick to my speech for the interest of time. I will talk about foreign policy and contemporary issue in Thailand's politics for maybe about 20 minutes, and I would be happy to entertain any question pertaining to the current crisis in Thailand. I'm happy to do so. But let me go into the talk today. Thailand foreign policy has been little studied, as I said. This is perhaps, as I would like to quote what my good friend, Professor Duncan McCargo, has said, just as Britain is sometimes said to have no climate, only weather, a consistent Thai foreign policy stance cannot always be readily discerned. Inconsistency, or perhaps simply an overarching pragmatism, has been a recurrent feature of Siam or Thailand's dealings with the wider world. Such pragmatism was perhaps most explicitly seen during the Second World War, when the Phibun Songkram government formed an alliance with Japan and declared war on the United States. However, Seni Pramod, then ambassador to Washington, failed to deliver the declaration. When the Allies emerged as victors, Thailand was quick to claim that the pro-Allies Free Thai resistance movement had represented the real stance of wartime nation, an argument which was broadly accepted by the Americans. In other words, Thailand succeeded in being on both sides of World War II, a rare feat of foreign policy flexibility. Not for nothing has the Thai Foreign Ministry traditionally prided itself on a mastery of bamboo diplomacy. In my word, I call it two-faced diplomacy. By the 1980s, however, such diplomacy was coming under strain. Whereas both the pre-1932 absolute monarchy and the military-dominated post-1932 regimes were characterized by the concentration of power in the hands of a tiny elite. With elite diversification came a new form of inconsistency, the pursuit of different policies by different ruling groups. This was more clearly seen during the ill-fated Chacha Chunhwan government of 1988 to 1991, which saw a struggle of control of foreign policy toward Indochina. As elected prime minister with a group of well-educated and iconoclastic advisors, the so-called Ban Pisanulok team, they sought to engage with Vietnam and end the isolation, turning the battlefield of Indochina into a marketplace. Meanwhile, the foreign ministry remained wedded to the American ASEAN orthodoxy of punishing Vietnam for the crime of invading Cambodia in 1979, while the Thai military took matters a stage further by actively supporting residual elements of the Khmer Rouge, three Thai government agencies, three Cambodian policies. As the first elected head of Thai government for over a decade, Cha Chai sought to wrest a policy decision out of the hands of the foreign ministry bureaucrats. Meanwhile, the military continued to assert the right to pursue its own regional agenda invoking the trump card of national security. The Cha Chai government was ousted by a military coup in February 1991, but the army only won a pyrrhic victory. Within a couple of years, a UN intervention has restored Cambodia to a tentative normalcy. The ASEAN blockade was lifted, and soon afterwards, President Bill Clinton restored America's diplomatic relations with Vietnam. Cha Chai team has demonstrated that Thailand's diplomats and soldiers were behind the times. Failing to think creatively and to rise to the challenges of a post-Cold War environment, new ideas came from elected politicians and a team of smart advisors who were willing to think outside the box. In the event, attempts by the leaders of the 1991 coup to assume power through civilian means ended in failure following the bloody Bangkok Street clashes of May 1992. The extended 1991 to 1992 political crisis led to the crafting of the 1997 reformist constitution, opening up liberal space of elected politicians to play the lead role in Thailand's governance. Into this first step, a new style of Thai politician, and I must pronounce his name correctly, Police Lieutenant Colonel Dr. Thaksin Shinawat, a former police officer with an American doctorate. Thaksin had become fabulously rich through winning a series of government concessions in the telecommunications sphere. While his competitors were badly hit during the Asian financial crisis of 1997, Thaksin had walked through the storm untouched, emerging as dominant player in Thailand's booming mobile phone business. His Thai Rak Thai Party, meaning Thais love Thais, won electoral victories on an unprecedented scale in 2001 and 2005. Like Cha Chai Chunhwan, Thaksin sought to check up the sluggish Thai bureaucracy and approach key areas of domestic and foreign policy with a private sector mentality. Unlike Cha Chai Chunhwan, Thaksin quickly achieved unparalleled dominance of Thailand's key institutions and resources, presenting himself as a CEO prime minister who was on a mission to make Thailand more productive, competitive, and goal-oriented. But again, like Cha Chai Chunhwan, Thaksin was ousted in a military coup. His shake-up of the existing order ruffled feathers and antagonized much of the traditional elite. Since 2001, Thai politics has been characterized by an intense contestation between the old bureaucratic elite, including what MacArthur termed network monarchy, and Team Thaksin, a set of alliances centered on the ex-prime minister and his family. Most crudely, These clashes have recently been acted out between yellow shirt and red shirt protesters on the street of Bangkok. These conflicts penetrate and polarize institutions such as the foreign ministry, undermining traditional styles of aristocrat privilege and prerogative. More than any previous civilian prime minister, Thaksin sought to impose his own personal agenda, often difficult to separate from his family business interests. Upon the core agency of Thai state, foreign policy was deployed both domestically and internationally to market the Thaksin message to a range of policies, including the Asia Cooperation Dialogue, or ACD, the Ayeyavadi Jaupaya Mekong Economic Cooperation Strategy, or ACMEX, a range of new foreign free trade agreements, and most colorfully through doomed attempts to engineer the appointment of his ministerial kickstart surrogate Satyen Thai to the post of UN Secretary General. It is no exaggeration to state that in his heyday, Thaksin acted as if he ruled the world. Foreign policy became an extension of Thaksin's domestic agenda, a tool for him to strengthen his power position, which did not always serve national interests. He readjusted foreign policy nature and contents, reaching for a status of regional leader, especially when the old charismatic figures had left the scene, including Singapore Lee Kuan Yew, Indonesia's Suharto, and Malaysia's Mahathir. He played with the theme of Asia for Asians, highlighting a business aspect of his foreign policy, while injecting a sense of Thai nationalism, sometimes Asian nationalism, as he dealt with foreign powers and institutions. Remember when Thaksin declared, "The UN is not my father," and he also criticized the US as a useless friend when the US failed to protect a Thaksin government from a criticism of the UN regarding the extrajudicial killing of 2,500 people, a drug suspect. In his mind, the bamboo policy has gone. Thailand no longer had to bend with the wind, but he would bend the prevailing wind to benefit Thailand's interest as well as his own interest. In this same process, Thaksin downplayed such standard foreign ministry preoccupations as its snobby fixation with Europe, and stopped paying endless lip service to the lackluster regional body ASEAN. Deploying an Asian nationalist rhetoric, Thaksin diverted foreign policy resources into supporting economic initiatives aimed at preserving and boosting Thailand's role as a dominant player in the Golden Peninsula of mainland Southeast Asia. He was also probably the first Thai leader to take the subcontinent seriously, recognizing India as an emerging power and positioning Thailand as a broker between East and Southeast Asia. But there are also many oversights in Thaksin foreign policy. This was a populist diplomacy, overly nationalistic, crude and full of gimmicks. Thaksin mixed national interests with his own interests. Foreign policy was implemented to benefit his Shin Corporation. For example, in 2004, Thaksin approved a soft loan package for Burma to upgrade its telecom infrastructure. And at Thaksin intervention, the Export-Import Bank of Thailand was ordered to increase its credit line to Burma from 3 to 4 billion baht. The loans were extended to finance the deal with Shin Satellite, which was then under the control of the Thaksin family. The Supreme Court of Thailand, in its 26 February assets seizure ruling, found that a conflict of interest has existed. His execution of FTAs also benefited his cronies. Kasit Piromya, current foreign minister and known anti-Thaksin figure, accused Thaksin of using official trip to fulfill his private interests. But Kasit himself is a controversial figure, so I don't know whether we really can trust what he say. So the crucial point here is that Thaksin, despite being a proud creator of many, many foreign policy initiatives, did not really invest in strengthening good governance as part of his diplomacy. This explains why his foreign policy was unsustainable, plastic, and at time highly autocratic. In retrospect, it seems all too predictable that Thaksin's manic iconoclasm and his headstrong slaughter of Sacred Crown both at home and abroad, would end really badly. Following the 19 September 2006 military coup, Thaksin found himself charged with corruption-related offenses and was sentenced to a jail term in 2008. Yet by the time the verdict was announced, Thaksin has already fled Thailand and became a professional fugitive, flitting between London, Hong Kong, and Dubai and other locations, rapidly wearing out his welcomes. This was an ironic fate for the most internationally oriented of Thailand's prime ministers, the man who had made so many foreign policy initiatives, had nowhere left to go. At present, I see the true control of Thaksin fate seem to remain firmly in the hands of his opponents, the Bangkok elite. I recently even suggested in Asia Sentinel that Thaksin's life was a Hollywood favorite plot. Okay, here's the plot. A populist prime minister falls from grace, gets overthrown in a military coup, goes on the run from Thai law as a fugitive, and is now charged over his alleged role as a chief operator of a terrorist network. As dramatic as it sounds, this is not fiction, but it's Thaksin real life. Looking at his notorious diplomatic record, one fails to understand why today Thaksin still has the audacity to request the international community to protect his integrity. In his recent statement, Thaksin accused the Apisit Wechachiwa government of blatantly breaching its obligations as a member of the international community and the United Nations Human Rights Council in regard to the crackdown a few weeks ago. And Thaksin is now attempting to bring the government to court for alleged human rights violations. I'm not here to defend the Apisit government. I think, after all, it needs to urgently justify the massive death toll of 89 people killed in a series of clashes between the security forces and the red shirt protester from April to May 2010. Legitimately or otherwise, the government dispersal attempts of demonstrators led to one of the most gruesome bloodlettings in Thailand modern history. And like it or not, Apisit Wechachiwa has already gone down in that disreputable historical record, just like Thaksin, who ordered the extrajudicial killings of drug suspects in 2003. Thaksin's botched foreign policy is returning to haunt him today. His latest reincarnation as an alleged international terrorist will further shrink his already limited global sanctuaries. Thailand's traditional elites in the West have long disapproved of his kind of diplomacy. They are working closely with the establishment forces, comprising a large faction in the Thai military, the bureaucracy, and those associated with the palace. Not only to delegitimize Thaksin's past, but also to undermine Thaksin's political movements. The U.S. did not harshly reproach the military coup that ousted Thaksin in 2006, although all military aid given to the Thai army was suspended. But the annual Cobra Grove military exercise between the U.S. and Thailand continued. Also, following the first violent clashes on the 10th April 2010, the U.S. heavily criticized the pro-Thaksin red shirt protester for provoking security forces. The Obama administration, also as a symbol of legitimizing the current government of Apisit Wechachiwa, extended an invitation to the prime minister to attend the nuclear conference in Washington, D.C. in April 2010. To the red shirts, the U.S. had done nothing to promote democracy and the elimination of double standards and injustice in Thailand. Apart from the U.S., other powers have also maintained good ties with the traditional power holders in Thailand. The British government revoked his visa, Thaksin visa. China quietly told Thaksin to leave the country so as not to upset the Bangkok elite. Recently, France made sure that his public lecture was canceled due to Thailand's tense situation. Thaksin's glorious days in the diplomatic world has so far failed to convince world leaders of how he was once a great CEO who put Thailand at the forefront of the international politics. I would like to quote an American academic, Michael Montesano, who is my colleague in Singapore, and who has said, Thaksin's approach to international relations in an era of globalization, confused vision with gimmicks, ambition with crudeness, dynamism with greed, national with personal interests, international with domestic politics, dreams of leading international organizations with contempt for those organizations, and the timely democratization of the Thai Foreign Ministry with its cancerous politicization. Thailand and Southeast Asia continue to live with the consequences of Thaksin's botched foreign policy. And as I wrote in the South China Morning Post yesterday, the Han game is still continuing. The ruling elites in Bangkok have continued to exert their influence while utilizing their international networks to track down Thaksin, to try to bring him home to serve his jail sentences. In the past 3 years after the military coup, after the coup, the establishment forces have attempted to alienate Thaksin on the global stage. They have been drafting a number of extradition treaties with several countries where Thaksin is said to have been residing. Thaksin is becoming an unwanted man, especially in countries that have maintained their traditional good ties with the establishment forces. And the latest strategy to isolate Thaksin is to assign an anti-Thaksin figure as a Thai ambassador to Washington. His name is Kittipong Naranong, who is currently Director General of the East Asian Department of the Foreign Ministry. He'll be taking up the post later this year. Considered rather junior in his rank, Kittipong has been endorsed by Foreign Minister Kasit Pirom to work closely with the U.S. in furthering undermining Thaksin's political legacy. So the battle game clearly does not limit itself within the Thai border. The accusation against Thaksin of being the leader of a terrorist group is perceived as another bold diplomatic move by the anti-Thaksin faction in the Thai Foreign Ministry. With this accusation, Thailand's foreign counterparts would find it hard to welcome Thaksin in their countries. This is because not only it could jeopardize their relations with the Thai government, but they could actually breach international law if such accusations are eventually proven right. As the Han game becomes increasingly intensified, one wonders if Abhisit Wechachiwa's reconciliation plans could really heal the rift in Thai society. Isolating Thaksin is not the way out of Thailand's protracted crisis. Using international allies to pressure Thaksin, to me, could, on the other hand, allow him to gain more sympathy from his diehard fans in the poorest regions of Thailand. The story of Thaksin foreign policy and how it has caused an impact on his present political move abroad is fascinating, but understudy, as I said. And my newly released book, Reinventing Thailand, Thaksin and His Foreign Policy, is my daring attempt to explain this astonishing state of affairs, the affairs that involve Thaksin's, the conflict of Thaksin's with the Bangkok elite, that involve Thailand domestic politics and foreign affairs. And the fierce interaction, as I said, between the Bangkok elite and Thaksin, both within the domestic domain and on the global stage. And on that note, I would like to end my presentation, and I'll be happy to take a question and answer.
Thank you. So I think the response from Thailand's neighbor to situation in Thailand is they wear it, and it depends on what country you from what country, what perspective you're looking at.
We're confused. You're coming today to Hong Kong, we're asking for more suffrage and right to vote here. I think you live in a country which has a dynasty and one party, yet if there's an election tomorrow, Thaksin would probably win 60% of the vote. What's wrong with that? What's wrong with that?
Could you please just
if there were a vote in Thailand today, what would you reword the question?
Please, could you reveal your identity?
Oh, my identity. Oh, Sam Moon, CEO of Thailand.
So, I get your question. Yes, if there would be an election tomorrow, Thaksin would win. And I think, like it or not, you know, starting off, I'm not a fan of Thaksin. I'm still not a fan of Thaksin. But you must say that you might understand that this guy has done something really good for, you know, for the country. For the first time, you know, in Thai modern history, he's the first prime minister to really look back at this poorest region. And he was very clever to be able to win hearts and minds of these people. I have done so many interviews with the red shirt, you know, from the north and northeast regions. I asked, what attracted you? You know, why you support a Thaksin, and you willing to go, you know, to any extent to defend him? Even though he's a corrupt man, you know, this is what said. Yes, we know he's a corrupt man, and who else in Thailand not corrupt? I said yes, true. but they said that at least Thaksin corrupt, but he returned something to the Thai. Whereas, you know, those people in Bangkok, they ignored the majority of the Thai, and the domination of power is still in the hand of the Bangkok elite. That's why I said, and I think if there would be election tomorrow, these people, they would work for Thaksin once again because of that, for the benefit, no matter how shallow those benefits were. And again, this is also justified the reason why this is very charged. He was still dragging this for not calling for an election, because in his heart he fully know that he will be able to win election, the upcoming election, let alone, you know, for him to travel to do campaign in the north, in the northeast region, he's not really welcome. And the reconciliation plan, I just talked to Philip, I don't understand at all. I don't know whether whom the government want to reconcile with. I mean, the government has never been clear. The government want to reconcile with Thaksin, or want to reconcile with the red shirt. Then who else? Who is the red shirt? We have, you know, the radical red shirt. We have the moderate red shirt. Or, I mean, it has not been clear. I think what the current government do is just providing time. And I think eventually the red shirt will come back. And have heard that they already have gone underground. I'm afraid that, you know, the future of Thailand will not be as many people have hoped to be. It will take some time until Thailand can get back to where it was once.
I'm Toh Han Shi from South China Morning Post. Three questions, but I won't take too long. What is the Singapore government's current balancing act towards Thaksin and the Thai government? My second question is, after the King of Thailand dies and the Crown Prince, and if the Crown Prince of Thailand takes over as King, what will happen to Thaksin? And my third question is, are you able to comment? I mean, the Crown Prince of Thailand must know he has a very bad reputation. Why doesn't he behave himself and clean up his act?
I think you really want to put me in jail. I don't know whether you know there's a thing called Les Majestés Law. Okay, I will try my best. I don't want to talk so much about Singapore because I'm living in Singapore. And for the record, I'm so grateful for Singapore. Seriously, I just think that, I mean, seriously, I mean, at my institute, we have a conference not long ago about the impact of Thaksin and Thailand relationship with Singapore. And we were really frank. We come to the conclusion that maybe it's time that the Singapore government, we have to understand more, you know, when they go into doing business or, you know, doing, you know, have political activities in a given country, we have to understand local reality. I think Singapore, and this is not my word, Singapore failed to appreciate changes in Thailand, including the, you know, the rise of pluralism in Thailand, that, you know, Thai people, they no longer have one single mind. And I think Singapore has to overcome it. In fact, there is a recent survey saying that, you know, the damage caused by Temasek in the aftermath of the controversial sale, it would take Singapore up to 10 years for Singapore to be able to recreate a very good image of itself in Thailand. Right now, a lot of Thai people look at Singapore as ugly Singaporeans, just like at one time we look at the Japanese. Move away from Singapore. Yes. What's next then if the current king passes from the scene? I think this is a very tough issue, and there's a lot of uncertainty ahead. The problem which I've been talking over and over is that I think it's time that Thai society needs to open up, that we need to discuss the succession issue, the question, because even talking about the succession issue is a taboo, and you're not supposed to talk about it. And it's been getting really worse because anyone can go to the police station and, you know, can file a complaint with the police and you can be arrested. And it has been used as a political weapon to undermine the opponents. I think by succession law, it seems clear that his son, the crown prince, Prince Vajiralongkorn, would be succeeding the throne. I have heard so many reports that the crown princess, the much loved princess Maha Chakrisinihorn, I don't think she's interested in the throne. I have heard that she said to her, you know, her servant that, you know, if she just want to live a quiet life if her dad passes away. I think in fact maybe it's a good thing that, you know, the crown prince should succeed the throne, because I think it's time that we should have a monarch who strictly stay above law, who might not be interested in politics, but interested in other things, like women. So I think maybe, you know, seriously, maybe it's a good thing, you know, because, I mean, royal intervention in the past, for many Thai people, is a blessing. But to me, I think it's not only a blessing, but it's a part of the problem that we have today. Yes. So I think maybe if, you know, those in the palace come to terms with, you know, the negative side of the royal intervention, perhaps maybe we should really discuss what would be the role of the future king, and that role must be strictly apolitical. The last question, I don't know what to say. There has been an attempt from the palace in recent years to recreate a new image of the crown prince. If you're familiar with the Thai culture, at every day at 8 p.m., you see news, and usually it's royal news. We see more and more of him, you know, going out and about on behalf of the king, going with his beautiful wife, the third one. I think the third one. You're not wrong. You know, to open up, you know, building for, you know, to go for, you know, charity work. It's a little bit too late for me. The damage done, and it's very complicated. Talking about the crown prince, you have to talk about the mother, and I don't want to go any further. Maybe we can talk, you know, off you.
Moon again. Do you see a role for the military in politics, especially since anywhere else in the world, except for a handful of countries, have any say in politics? And then related to this other question, General Prim, is he a good guy, bad guy, like Darth Vader or Prince Charming?
Prim, he's about 90, I think he's gonna live until 120. So you might as well have to bear with him. He'll be here for a long, long time. Thai military has always been in politics, and it's difficult to separate the military from politics. I mean, unlike in the Indonesian case, politicians get together to eliminate the military. Thai politicians involve the military so that they could remain in power. Because of that, I think it's very difficult to separate the military from politics. Moreover, I think those who associate with the palace, for example, General Prem, he has used military to strengthen his power position, linking up the role of the military in politics with the need to protect the monarchy. And that's why, you know, in this current crisis, there's a lot of talks about the monarchy being under attack, under threat. That's why, you know, the military will have still need to be involved in politics. We cannot really alienate the military. So in a way, it's a very legitimate way for the politicization of the military, or you can call it for the militarization of politics. But I think things will get more difficult now. The military is no longer a unified entity. You know, that's why we have the notion of watermelon military. We have tomato police. I think Thai people really like fruits and vegetables. I think there's since Thaksin came along in 2001, I think in his mind he believed that the only way he could take away the political power dominated by the Bangkok elite is to create a fragmentation between the military. And he did so successfully by, you know, appointing his own relative, you know, one of the Jero Chaisik Chinawat to be the army chief. Because of that, I think since 2001, there's a lot of factions within the military, and it's getting worse now that we see the polarization in Thai politics. I think there's a lot of high-ranking military men today who see the interest and benefit in working with Thaksin, because these people never been in the network, the so-called monarchy network. So they might as well work with Thaksin, so that because they understand that Thaksin is a long-term interest. And the Red Church will come back for the next election. So they might as well put the money, you know, where they can gain benefit, you know, in the post-election period. And this become a main source of funding for the Red Church. People, you know, believe that Thaksin is the only main source of funding. It's no longer like that. Thaksin become poorer after the court case on February 26th. But I think the Red Church also gained a lot of, you know, funding from wealthy military men. Okay, that is the high-ranking military men. Now we're talking about the foot soldiers, the junior ranking. These people, most of them come from the north and the northeast region, barely poor. And they see their parents suffering over the years, over the past few decades. They understand that, you know, the Bangkok, the elite in Bangkok never really paid attention to their parents, you know. They were poor 30 years ago, they're still poor today. So I think these foot soldiers became very sympathetic toward the Red Church. And that's why you can see a sense of reluctance, unwillingness for the military to really go all out against the Red Church during the crisis in April and May, which made things very difficult for the opposite caution.
Hey, Paul Murray, I'm a medic in Hong Kong. What do you think could be done in the Northeast to undermine Thaksin's influence there and his hold over the people? What practical initiatives do you think could be undertaken by the present government?
Can you repeat your question?
What practical initiatives do you think could be taken by the present administration to undermine Thaksin's sway over people in the Northeast?
I think it comes down to policy here. That's why I have been saying that this government is not really wise. You know, after sitting himself, he's getting more stupid, more and more stupid each day. I think I think there is a sense among people, among the bank companies, that by empowering them, by empowering the people in the North and Northeast, you make them more intelligent. And because of that, it could be a threat to the bank companies. Where Thaksin totally, you know, think differently. You know, Thaksin used them, you know, empowering them to support Thaksin's own power position. And that's why I think that this there is two separate tactics here. I think the bank of elites, the current government, they're still unable to do so. I think there's a lot of people in the administration who still believe in the domination of power and not really care that much about winning heart and minds of the people in the Northeast. So I don't think that is one of the main agenda of the current government, sadly. They do not believe that, that I think in their mind they believe that with or without the support of the North and Northeast people, they can maintain their power position, which I think is wrong. It's totally wrong. And it's really sad to hear the yellow shirt saying that, you know, why should we give power to the people in the North and Northeast? Because these people, they're stupid. They're uneducated. They are easily manipulated by greedy politicians like Thaksin Shinawatra. That's why, you know, the PAD, the People Alliance for Democracy, even come up with a new politics with, you know, in their own mind, the future parliamentarians should consist of 70% of those appointed and only 30% elected, because they believe that, you know, we should not give power to the poor in the North and the Northeast. I think it is totally wrong, and they really underestimate the intelligence of the people in the poor villages. You know, I think that this is a totally new game now. The people in North and Northeast really understand what is happening. There is an awakening of political consciousness among them.
Kay Rogers, a member of FCC, as you put it. Whilst all this has been going on with Thaksin and now the red shirt, what's been happening to the Muslims in the south, the Rohingya people, the people on the borders in Myanmar, the Karen? All this is sitting there, just simmering away. Has anything changed?
I don't know a lot of what's happening in the South Thailand. I have not really been following it. But what I can say is that it's a sad reality, because of Thai people have become a preoccupied with politics in Bangkok, and they simply overlook what is happening in the South Thailand. The situation is still really bad. The killing of you know, of the people in the South Thailand has become normalized. It is okay, I'm sorry to say, but it is okay to see on a newspaper in Thailand that five people got killed in the south. It's okay. And that is very dangerous. I don't think the government has has any interest. I don't think the government has any resources. I don't think the government even understands what happened in the south. And that's why I think the issue has been left unattended. I think worse is, I mean, I've been talking to a lot of Thai as well. They still have this fixed mentality about Thailand being a very homogeneous society. You know, this is a perfect country, a land of smile. You know, we believe in, you know, in the monarchy, we believe in Buddhism. And because of that, you kind of, you know, continue to alienate or isolate the Thai Muslim itself, which I think is really wrong. I don't think, not until the situation in Bangkok has been solved, then the government would have more time to deal with the issue in the South Thailand. And I mean, I'm not really optimistic about the situation in Bangkok can be resolved within the next year, not even after the election, because you're talking about the post-election period, then you have to look at the post-Phumiphol period. I don't know when the king, you know, will stay on, and then the aftermath in the, you know, the succession process, it will be a long ride. Thailand, I would say, in the next 5 to 10 years, will not be the same.
Yes, hi, I'm George Long, a hedge fund investor. Two questions. If my memory is correct, Thaksin was in Laos, or I believe Laos, a year and a half ago, and seemed to be trying to stir things up. What is your interpretation of what he was trying to do in Laos? I mean, Laos wouldn't be, isn't strong enough to take on Thailand. I mean, did it have to do with Northeast Thai politics, or is he just trying to stir up trouble around the periphery? And then the second question, you mentioned in your talk the extrajudicial killings. What is your interpretation of that? One of the interpretations is he was just trying to clean up drug traffickers without having to waste time in a court, but other people interpret it as taking out political opponents. If you can touch on those two questions. Thank you.
I'm not sure if you can answer the first question. You talked about Laos.
Yes, didn't he go to Laos? He went to Cambodia, yes. And he clearly seemed, and just my naive reading of the press, he clearly seemed to be stirring up, trying to stir up Thai-Cambodian relations or something to antagonize the central government or something. Why was he in Cambodia, and what was he trying to do in Cambodia?
Okay. Yes, Cambodia, yes. It's my third issue, in fact. I was in Cambodia in 2003 when the Thai embassy was burned down. I had to run for my life. And I was not even stationing there. I was there to do as part of, the foreign ministry committee. Relationship has been erratic, partly because of the historical what will happen in the past. The Cambodian looked up to Thai and they felt that they have been looked down, Thai businesses exploited a lot, from the Cambodian. Also, the case of the Pravi here, of Pravihan in Thai, since 1962, it has not been, in fact, it should have been settled, but it has not been settled because of, Thai nationalism, because of the yellow shirt, who used this issue to undermine, the Thaksin back government, including the Samak and also Songchai Wongsawat government. What I can say is that, the whole relationship has been held hostage by a domestic politics in Thailand. And I mean, one of them is the current Foreign Minister, Kasit Pirong, who, before he became a Foreign Minister, he went on a Thai television, Thai talk show, and then he just slashed Hun Sen. I could not imagine that he used to be our ambassador to Washington. He called Hun Sen the gangster of Southeast Asia. He called Hun Sen that this guy is mad, he's a slave of Thaksin. And then Cambodia does not wish to have good relationship with Thailand. So because of that thing, I think it become a victim of domestic politics, and I think it's time for Hun Sen to really strike back, which you have seen, lately. Hun Sen came out to support Thaksin, and he even said that, majority of Thai people who support Thaksin, then why can't I support Thaksin? So it's fair enough. Well, okay, quickly, I think time is up. The last thing is about the killing of drugs. We still talk about that today. What did the man Thaksin? Why Thaksin order the extrajudicial killing over 2,500 people? One of the story, I don't know whether it's real or it's a joke, because Thaksin was so concerned that his son became, a drug addict. And then he was so angry, that's why it became a family business. That's why he ordered the crackdown. I think he want to come across as a leader who really has determination. And I think at the time, the issue of drugs was kind of very serious. And maybe, he just get carried away. I really don't have any answer for you in regard to this issue specifically. But that is my thought.
Thank you very much. I'm going to breach the rules of one last, one final question myself, which can be answered in one word, I hope. And that is, Kaveen, you said that the future of the current prince would be a figurehead monarch. Is the current monarch more than a figurehead anymore?
How should I put this? I think the key understanding is that when we look up to the Thai monarchy, we look at a person, and we don't look at an institution. So basically, the love and respect that the Thai people have, it only go to King Kun Ponnadurede. So not really to the institution. So I think and to better he set the bar so high, it's almost impossible for anyone to follow him, to follow in his footsteps. So I think it would be very hard for the new one, the new Peter Hay, to have to, you know, rebuild the institution once again. And I don't think it's going to be an easy job because of his reputation, that the incoming one. Basically, I think it's time for the Muna. We have to go. I have to undergo the reform.
Thank you very much for that. I'm afraid we have to leave this. Thank you, Dr. Badian, very much indeed.